Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, December 11th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Norwegian Cooking, Crumb Cake, Lefse, and More. First Lutheran Church celebrates its heritage with Norwegian treats. It's written by Earl Horlick of the Sioux City Journal. The dateline is Sioux City. The Reverend Christine Stegji had a sweet way of getting parishioners at First Lutheran Church into a holiday mood. She organized a Christmas bake-off. The church would supply the butter, flour, and sugar, while our members supplied their own aprons, rolling pins, and storage containers to take home the goodies, she explained Saturday morning as more than two dozen people filed into the fellowship hall of the 3939 Cheyenne Boulevard Church. The idea was to create a casual exchange of recipes as well as an opportunity to learn how to make the perfect crumb cake. Okay, we're already stumped. What the heck is a crumb cake? Simply put, it's a waffle-like cookie that's normally rolled into the shape of a cone. The cookie originated in Norway. You see, many of our parishioners are of Norwegian descent, Stegji said. Since many baking recipes come from family, it is only natural that many of our desserts will be Norwegian. David Gross is apparently the king of crumb cake, or at least he's the one who actually owns an electric crumb cake iron. The trick is to get the batter inside of the iron as soon as it gets hot enough, Gross informed Stegji, who was a crumb cake making newbie. It's essential to remove the crumb cake from the iron the very second they're cooked through. That said, there's differences in individual preferences for how well done they should be. Are you sure about that, David? Stegji asked. I think they look and taste better with a bit of color. No, they must be pale white and bland, Gross explained. That's the Norwegian way. Gross's batter was flavored with sugar and cardamom, while Norwegian baking is notable for its uses of butter, flour, shortening, and, well, that's about it. This was certainly the recipe for Julie Thiel's lefse, a soft flatbread made on a griddle, but she also used rice potatoes to give it more body. I've eaten lefse my entire life, but I didn't make it myself until I went to Norway with my mom 15 years ago, she said. Maybe we wanted to embrace our Norwegian heritage, but we both started using Norwegian recipes. While Thiel preferred eating her lefse with a simple topping of butter and sugar, Bev Rosenkranz likes to experiment with the jellies she uses in her thumbprint cookies. Thumbprint cookies are their name from the middle imprint where you fill it in, she said. This year, I'm using a red pepper jelly to make it more festive. Dorothy Getch's flavored baked good is packed with flavor. I've been making peanut butter balls for as long as I can remember, she said. Once I roll the batter into the shape of a ball, I cover them with chocolate. My grandsons go crazy for them because they have so much flavor. Wait, chocolate-covered peanut butter balls? That doesn't seem as traditional as the other Norwegian offerings. I probably shouldn't say this out loud, Getch said with a wink, but I'm really not Norwegian. Dorothy Chauncey is definitely Norwegian. The spry 90-year-old makes sandbockles, a butter cookie, from her grandmother's recipe. You have to put the batter into the mold just right, she said, while instructing sandbackle newbie Jean Hannah looked on. Otherwise, they'll stick and you'll never get them out. Pressing sweetened mixture into special sandbackle's mold, Chauncey reminisced about spending time on her grandparents' farm. My grandparents' house was heated with a pot-bellied stove and no indoor plumbing, she said with a laugh. You learn that the Sears Roebuck Christmas catalog was more than just reading material when there was no indoor bathroom. Watching her congregation shared stories as well as sweet treats put a smile on Stegji's face. The holidays are all about fun, fellowship, and food, she said. Our Christmas bake-off combined all three. Next is a story entitled Council to Vote on Development Agreement. Equipment distributor plans to move business park near airport. It's written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to approve a development and minimum assessment agreement with a distributor of construction and mining equipment. Road Machinery and Supplies Company is relocating its Sioux City operations to Expedition Business Park by Sioux City Gateway Airport. This past summer, the company expressed interest in purchasing land in the Expedition Business Park at the intersection of Al Haynes Drive and Discovery Boulevard for a new location for their Sioux City operation. The Minnesota-based company currently has a location at 1400 Lewis Boulevard. As part of the project, the company proposes to purchase the 11.47-acre parcel from the city and construct a 10,080-square-foot facility. The facility will include offices, high bay space for servicing equipment, a wash bay, and space for outdoor storage of equipment and machinery. The proposed purchase price is $37,897 per acre for a total price of $434,679. Six existing jobs will be retained, and the company will likely add new employees as it expands its presence in the region, according to city documents. Under the terms of the development and minimum assessment agreement, Road Machinery and Supplies Company will purchase Lot 5 for $434,679, construct a new heavy equipment sales and service center on the parcel, retain the existing 6 employees, and commit to a minimum assessed value of $2 million on the completed project for a period of 10 years. The company will also provide the city with a right of first refusal on the remnant property, which remains after the development of the original facility, according to the documents. The city, in turn, will sell Lot 5 in Expedition Business Park to Road Machinery and Supplies Company and provide a series of property tax rebates on a graduated scale as detailed in the development agreement. The documents state that the city will see immediate revenue through the proceeds of the land sale and will also see increased tax revenue through new development on the site. Grandview Park Overlay Project. The council will also weigh approving a resolution adopting plans, specifications, form of contract, and estimated cost for the construction of the FY 2024 Grandview Park Hot Mix Asphalt, or HMA, Overlay Project. The HMA overlay of the park road will preserve the road's integrity and mitigate damage to the park from the demolition of 2 water tanks in the park. The project includes the construction of public right-of-way accessibility guidelines compliant sidewalk ramps along the park road, a 1.5-inch HMA overlay of the park road, including the playground parking area, and the restriping of the playground parking lot. All construction work is scheduled to be completed before Saturday in the park on July the 6th, according to city documents. The documents state that city staff is ready to go out for bid on the project on Friday with a bid deadline of January the 9th. The project would have a late start date of May 20th and be completed within 20 working days. The engineer's opinion of probable construction cost for the base bid is $200,000. The engineer's opinion of probable cost with the bid alternate to allow the contractor to keep the asphalt millings is $195,000. Gordon Drive Viaduct Reconstruction. The Iowa Department of Transportation is also slated to give the City Council a presentation of the Gordon Drive Viaduct Reconstruction Project. Acquisition of right-of-way for a new Gordon Drive viaduct is slated to begin in 2027, and construction is to begin the following year of the project, which includes replacement of the city's Bacon Creek drainage conduit beneath a portion of the same area. The project is part of the 2024 through 2028 highway plan, which was approved in June by the Iowa Department of Transportation. Inclusion in the plan gives the DOT a firmer deadline to finalize designs in advance of letting the projects for construction bids. The IDOT has taken the lead in designing the entire project. Viaduct replacement is estimated at $118 to $144 million, and the conduit is estimated at $25 million to $34 million. The viaduct, which carries 20,000 vehicles daily, is in need of replacement rather than simply adding on to it as in past improvements, the IDOT has said. In the interest of trying to read more local news, I'll read some stories from the Storm Lake Times Pilot. The top story is entitled, City Says Officer Shortage Cuts Force Size. funds split up for raises. This is right by Tom Cullen and Amber Mohammed. The Storm Lake Police Department will undergo a 7% reduction in patrol staff to give officers, detectives, and lieutenants a 5% raise. One person from the patrol unit resigned in November, according to city manager Carrie Navratil. Instead of filling that position, the department will use the salary to give all officers, with the exception of the chief and assistant chief of police, a 5% raise. You're now looking at one less officer, but a 5% wage increase, Navratil told the city council, who signed off on the arrangement. Councilman Kevin McKinney wondered why the city reached a second agreement with Teamsters Local 554 in less than a year. Navratil said that it was a deal that would make the city competitive with neighboring law enforcement agencies of similar size and situation, at which point McKinney agreed. In order to stay competitive with all the pay rates that are going on and increasing for police departments and deputies, we wanted to offer a 5% increase to current officers, Navratil said. Hiring new police officers has been especially difficult for Storm Lake and other agencies across the nation. In Storm Lake's case, the issue has been severe to the point council members have asked about increasing turnover rates in the city's ranks. Navratil asserted the city's turnover rates among officers are in line with similar agencies, though she declined to specify which agencies she was comparing the city against. Last year, the city lost two sworn officers, or a 15% turnover rate among patrol officers. Our turnover rates aren't abnormal compared to cities similar to Storm Lake, Navratil said. The Storm Lake Police Department has 12 patrol officers, 4 lieutenants, and 2 detectives, around what the department has maintained since 2018, according to a review of annual reports the SLPD issues every February. Chief Chris Cole noted the department added 2 officers in recent years, aiming to cover gaps resulting from military deployments, training, and other factors. During the coronavirus pandemic, the department was beset by one of its most severe staffing shortages due to National Guard deployments. Unfortunately, despite our best efforts, we've encountered difficulty attracting suitable applicants for these additional positions, leaving them unfilled, said Cole, who acknowledged the department currently has 3 open patrol officer positions. The lowest number of sworn patrol officers, the report show, was 11 in the 2022 and 2019. The number has since grown to 13, but the agency, like many others in Buena Vista and surrounding counties, has struggled with finding qualified candidates despite hefty raises the council has doled out. In 2021, the city council gave SLPD officers raises ranges from 5% to 13%. Navratil pointed to raises the Buena Vista County Board of Supervisors gave sheriff's deputies in recent years. The most recent was an 8% raise. Competing with counties has been tough, she said. Compounding matters further, Hy-Vee has beefed up its hiring of security officers at its warehouse in Cherokee. Both Storm Lake and Buena Vista County have lost officers who pursued opportunities with the warehouse. Cole didn't address other employers who are competing with the county, but he added, several officers have resigned to pursue opportunities in the private sector, citing improved pay and better hours as motivating factors. And for whatever reason, fewer candidates than ever are attracted to working in any kind of law enforcement. Recent Civil Service Commission eligibility lists have dwindled to fewer and fewer names in recent years. The most recent list contained one name. Still, recent SLPD administrations have resisted suggestions at reductions in force. Former Police Chief Mark Prosser told the City Council every year that the SLPD was understaffed by comparison to other departments serving communities between 10,000 and 50,000 residents. In 2019, the FBI found the rate of full-time law enforcement officers per 1,000 inhabitants was 2.2 in cities in the Midwest. That means the SLPD should have 24 sworn officers based on current census estimates. The department, after the memorandum with the Teamsters takes effect, now has 12 patrol officers, 2 detectives, and 4 lieutenants. One of the patrol officers' positions remains unfilled. And by the city's own assertions, the number of people who live in Storm Lake is much higher than what census estimates suggest. Navarro believes the city's total population is 15,000, meaning it should have over 30 officers. Navarro asserted the community won't see a reduction in service as a result of the new agreement. A recent statistical report the SLPD released showed its top service category was patrol overtime, totaling 79 hours in the month of November. The second highest category, training, registered 22 hours. Cole also asserted there won't be a reduction in service. We believe that this adjustment is crucial for our agency to remain competitive, retain staff, and to continue delivering the highest level of service to our community, Cole wrote via email. The next article is entitled Pork Group Pitches In on Raccoon Water Projects. Critic, calls it PR stunt. This is written by Kate Keeley. Buena Vista and four other counties announced they will partner with the state of Iowa and the Iowa Pork Producers Association to build water conservation practices that claim to accelerate water quality progress. The Pig Farmer Water Quality Partnership Program aims to implement 65 edge-of-field practices such as bioreactors and saturated buffers across Iowa. The North Raccoon River and Boone River are the initial focus of the program, a collaboration of counties, the Iowa Department of Agriculture, the Iowa Pork Producers Association, and the Iowa Nutrient Research and Education Council. The partnership will help increase progress on water quality in the state, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig said in a statement. Our approach makes it easy for pork producers, farmers, and landowners to participate, and we invite everyone to join with us to keep building our water quality momentum, Naig said November 30th. Practices include bioreactors, trenches filled with wood chips that are colonized by bacteria. As water and nitrate flows through the bioreactor, the bacteria convert the nitrate into nitrogen gas. Another practice includes saturated buffers, perennial vegetation between fields and tiles connecting the fields. The saturated buffer serves as a filter for the contaminated runoff. The plant uses a batch and build model that installs batches of conservation practices on multiple farms at once, creating a faster acceleration of water quality progress, according to the statement. Project partners are expected to recruit farmers and landowners for the program. Farmers and landowners are invited to reach out if they are interested, said Donald McDowell, the communications director of the department. We want them to say yes to installing the practice on their farm, and our approach is intended to make the process simple to encourage participation, McDowell said via an email to the Times Pilot December the 1st. Funds from federal, state, and private agricultural associations have flowed to Buena Vista County in increasing amounts since the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit was filed in 2015. In January of 2022, the USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service doled out $3.2 million to 15 farmers to plant cover crops. In 2018, the Iowa legislature passed a bill that diverted $282 million in state money to agricultural conservation, similar practices that were supported in the recently announced partnership program. The county and the state formed the North Raccoon River Management Coalition years earlier to build the same practices the Pork Producers Association intends to support. Other associations have formed around water quality improvements in the Raccoon River watershed. The county, with IDALS last year, signed up farmers in the Highway 71 corridor to build wetlands that would reduce nutrient loads into the Raccoon. Proponents see the growing number of partnerships as evidence that conservation can grow at scale. Critics say the most recent conservation effort is evidence of no progress at all. Chris Jones, a retired engineering researcher at the University of Iowa, said the new practices will have no measurable effect on water quality. We would need untold thousands of these things across the landscape for it to really affect a large amount of change, Jones said in a phone interview. A saturated buffer system and bioreactors are effective on a 40-acre field, but to resolve nutrient pollution for 23 million acres of cropland in Iowa is an unrealistic expectation, Jones explained. When you pencil this out, the cost to address this problem in that manner, we just will never have that much money, Jones said. We just won't. And we all know that, yet agriculture wants to continue, to me, what amounts to a public relations strategy and not much a water quality strategy. Landowners can participate in the program at no cost. Saturated buffer installations cost $8,000. Bioreactors cost $15,000, according to IDALS. We are asking the taxpayer to pay for the diapers, which really don't have much capacity to affect change at the landscape level, Jones said. So we have this colossal problem. At least 600,000 people, or one-sixth of Iowa, drink water from the Raccoon River, not counting people who travel to Des Moines for the state fair, travels, or sports. The Boone River is a tributary to the Des Moines River. Both streams have effects on drinking water supply. Both of them have nitrate problems, Jones said. Despite the program's intent to accelerate water quality progress for the Raccoon and Boone Rivers, Jones said edge-of-the-field practices won't undo the damage done to both streams. Trying to address these landscape-scale problems by putting diapers at the end of tiles, it is not a strategic way to solve this problem, Jones said. It is a strategic way to create a narrative. Practice standards are set by the Natural Resource Conservation Services to require a minimum of criteria for the implementation of conservation measure in order for it to achieve its intended purpose. Each state has a different conservation practice standard. If the practice standard is low, then the effectiveness of the edge of the field practices is low, Jones explained. So as a consequence, a lot of these are going in that are not capturing much water because the NRCS is not requiring them to do that to be eligible for the money, Jones said. To know how much is going to affect water quality, I would need to see the specs on each individual practice. IDALS conducts an on-site survey of the area to determine which practice may be best suited for the land, McDowell noted. We then present the findings to the participating landowner, and then, if there is a green light, then we proceed to the final design and installation, McDowell said. Jones believes the farming system needs to be reorganized. There are nearly 4,000 concentrated animal feeding operations in Iowa. Of the 24 million acres of crops, 94% of that land is used to produce corn and soybeans, according to the 2021 National Agriculture Statistics Survey. Only 5% of land is a form of conservation practice. That share hasn't changed since the lawsuit was filed. We know that the corn, soy, CAFO production system is a leaky system, Jones said. It's going to pollute. We need more diverse systems, different sets of crops, and more diverse sets of crops, more diverse ways to raise animals. We know for certainty that it will produce better outcomes. And the final story from the front page of the Storm Lake Times Pilot, Alta Library eyes old hospital for relocation, community survey to go out in January. This is also written by Kate Keeley. City Councilwoman Pam Henderson told the board she is supportive of the city purchasing the old hospital and renting it out to the community. Next, the board plans to tour the old hospital building a second time with the mayor. That's what my vision is, to come to the table and collaborate with all kinds of people and entities, Henderson said at a special meeting Wednesday. We can't do it on our own. We have to combine somewhere. Members of the board recently toured two potential buildings for the relocation and discussed the options at the special meeting. The board decided the city library would need to move from the shared facility with the school district because of new state restrictions on materials for students. The first location is on Main Street, located on the north of the empty parking lot area by City Hall. It is roughly 1,100 to 1,500 square feet, which is smaller than the board wanted for the new location. The current shared library is around 3,000 square feet. Since the space has been divided by walls, the city's side is around 2,000 square feet. There are walls that would need to come down to open up the space on Main Street. It is a beautiful building, but there is no basement for storage, Nelson noted. There could be an add-on to double the space, board president Bruce Hinkledy suggested. It is very nice building inside, but it is rather small, said Hinkledy, agreeing with Nelson. The former Spectra Health Center on 7th Street, commonly known as the Old Hospital, is the second space the board toured. The board agreed the library would go on the first floor to make it handicap accessible. Although there is an elevator in the building, the existing walls can come down to open up the space because there are supporting columns. There is enough room for storage, a meeting area, and outdoor space for the library's activities. It's a great building, Hinkledy said. Like I said, we would have to think a lot bigger than just the library. The building has too much space for the library alone, so the city would have to look into renting the building out to other entities. The board discussed possible partnerships with Ready, Set, Grow Learning Center and Senior Meals. I think there could be some other departmental support, Nelson said. Not just us, but some other types of resources that are needed. I mean, rural areas need some of these services, and Alta doesn't have very much. Board approves survey for relocation. The Alta Community Library Board will release a survey asking citizens what amenities they would like to see in a new city library facility. The board approved the survey during a special meeting Wednesday evening. The survey will be available by January the 3rd and close January 21st. The survey will ask Alta residents how they use the current facility that is shared with the school district. Questions about preferences on the new location and resources at the new location will be included. Hard copies of the survey will be available at city locations around town, including the library and post office. They can be turned in at the library book drop or city hall drop box. The library board is coordinating with the Alta Aurelia School District to send out the survey via email to student parents. The survey will be offered in English and Spanish. Anyone can take the survey. The board hopes people of all ages and backgrounds take advantage of it, Library Director Gigi Nelson said. The board opted to not include questions about demographics and hopes to avoid detouring people by invading privacy. Turning back to the Sioux City Journal, I'll read an article entitled Haley in Iowa Draws Contrasts with Trump. Former UN ambassador says chaos follows former president. It's written by Aaron Murphy of the Journal Des Moines Bureau, and the dateline is Waukee, Iowa. For Sam Wells, an Iowa man in his 70s who describes himself as a formerly lifelong no-party voter who plans to participate in the Iowa Republican caucuses for the first time, Nikki Haley threaded the needle just right when talking about former President Donald Trump. Wells was one of the roughly 200 people who came to hear Haley, the Republican presidential candidate and former UN ambassador and South Carolina governor, speak at a campaign event held Sunday afternoon at a trucking and farming business just outside this western Des Moines suburb. Haley, as she has previously on the campaign trail, said Trump was the right president at the time and that she agrees with a lot of his policies, but Haley also, as she has more recently on the stump, said that chaos follows Trump and that she does not want to get into the personal attacks that are a staple of Trump's style of campaigning and governing. Haley served as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under then-President Trump. The way she approaches Trump is absolutely the right way to do it. Not get personal, talk about the issues and how to correct them, Wells said after hearing Haley speak. She was very positive. There wasn't anything I didn't like. Trump has held a consistently commanding lead over the rest of the Republican presidential candidates in polling both nationally and in Iowa. In the polls, Haley and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis are working to close that gap. Trump's polling average in Real Clear Politics rolling average of Iowa polls is 47.3%, while DeSantis is at 18.7% and Haley at 15.7%. In similar polling metrics, on the data journalism website 538.com, Trump is at 45.9%, DeSantis at 19.7%, and Haley at 17.5%. Wells said if Trump and Biden are the nominees for the 2024 presidential election, he will vote third party for either Robert Kennedy Jr. or retiring Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. Kennedy started out running for president as a Democrat and has since mounted an independent campaign. And since announcing he will not run for re-election to the U.S. Senate, Manchin has not ruled out running for president as an independent candidate. Wells, who lives in West Des Moines, said he came to Sunday's event about 80% sure he will support Haley in the January 15th First in the Nation Iowa Republican caucuses. That number went up after hearing Haley speak, he said. Being a woman, she brings a different perspective for how to attack problems, Wells said. We are in chaos as a country, and we cannot have another year of chaos. Phyllis Johnson, also from West Des Moines, needed even less convincing. Johnson said she was the first in her friend group to get behind Haley and has since volunteered to help the Haley campaign in Iowa. I think she's amazing. She addresses things without getting personal, Johnson said, adding that she believes Haley would, as president, be able to bring Americans together. Underlying the work left to be done for Haley and any Republican presidential candidate in Iowa, one woman in the crowd declined to be interviewed, but said she came to hear Haley because she is trying to choose between Haley and DeSantis. Haley, early in her remarks, asked how many in the crowd were hearing her speak for the first time. At least half of the crowd raised their hands. Haley closed the event with a plea to those who liked what they heard to spread the word about her campaign. I have been underestimated in everything I've ever done, and it's a blessing because it makes me scrappy, Haley said. No one will outwork me in this race. No one will outsmart me in this race because we have a country to save. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. I'll read the editorial from the Storm Lakes Time Pilot, and it's entitled Stupid Stubborn. The city of Storm Lake is set on a path to sue Buena Vista County over the misallocation of tax increment financing revenues that should have gone to the city. It occurred to us that the city council will be suing its own residents as taxpayers of Buena Vista County. This is how much sense a lawsuit makes. The matter has been discussed behind closed doors for a long time with lawyers. We do not know how much money was misallocated over a period of years. Was it $5 million, $10 million, or more? Where did the money go? No answers, at least to the public. They would prefer to reveal it to a judge. The city bears responsibility for not paying attention to its own funds. The county bears responsibility for messing up. Storm Lake property owners are stuck in the middle. As patrons of, say, the Storm Lake School District, if the mystery funds or a portion may have gone there, they will be victims of the litigation. Because we suggested it, the city and the county rejected the idea of asking the state auditor's office to get to the bottom of this. The auditor could figure out the particulars and advise the city and county as a neutral party how to sort it out. Auditor Rob Sand said he was willing. It would be embarrassing. The city would have to give up some of the funds it lost, and the county would have to do some begging to get the money back from wherever. It would avoid costly litigation. If the public actually knew the particulars, we should have this settled by now. These are taxpayer funds collected by government agencies, and the public has been shut out of the facts, the discussion, and the outcome. What the heck? Sue. It's been played as a board game with funny money, your money. City and county officials should have settled this a long time ago. Instead, it appears that they will just throw it on the lap of a district court to sort out as Storm Lake sues its own. It's stupid, costly, and unnecessary. Alternatives are available that should not require billable hours. Somebody should swallow their pride and get on a path to a settlement. We should not need lawyers and judges. We have elected and appointed officials who can do the job if they choose to. In a second editorial, Cheney's Temptation. Former Representative Liz Cheney got a bit full of herself when she suggested during a book tour interview with the Washington Post that she might like to mount a third party or independent presidential campaign in order to prevent Donald Trump from getting back into the White House. Cheney formerly was a Republican representative from Wyoming until she got beat in a primary. Cheney became a woman without a party when she co-chaired a House committee that investigated the January 6th insurrection. She could have come to Iowa and sought the Republican nomination if she wanted to deny Trump the nomination, or she didn't have to run per se. She could have barnstormed in Iowa ahead of the GOP candidates. She chose instead to write a valuable book, That's okay. Stay on the talk shows, write op-eds, go for it. But she had her chance to run for either Democratic or Republican nominations, neither of which she could win. She would join a queue of people who think they could run outside the two parties: Joe Manchin, Cornel West, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Jill Stein, Larry Hogan. Who have we forgotten anyone? Each would have the same effect of draining away support from President Joe Biden. The person who can deny Trump the presidency is Joe Biden and not anybody else. Cheney knows this. She knows the real reason Al Gore lost to George W. Bush. He couldn't carry his home state of Tennessee. Cheney should spend these remaining weeks getting the message to Iowa Republicans that Donald Trump is not their electoral interests. Her arguments are compelling and true. Cheney is a patriot who stood up for the democratic process. It cost her a House seat and made her persona non grata in the party her hot father helped build. She remains credible to a large block of Republican voters who could benefit by hearing from her directly in Iowa. Her message should be, if Trump is the nominee, vote for Biden. It would be liberating for her just to blurt it out. There's one obituary in the Storm Lake Times Pilot, and it's Marcella Broderson. A mass of Christian burial for Marcella Broderson, age 100, was held Monday, December the 4th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Milford. Burial was at Calvary Cemetery. Turner Genis Funeral Home in Milford was in charge of arrangements. Oh, move on to read some sports. In local sports, Storm Lake girls beat Emmitsburg, are 5-0 for first time in 15 years. The Tornadoes won 40-27. Adia Yanga scored 19 points to help Storm Lake start 5 wins, 0 losses for the first time since the year 2008 as the Tornadoes got past Emmitsburg 40-27 on Tuesday at Tornado Fieldhouse. Storm Lake scored the first 11 points of the game and led 11-0 after the first quarter. Emmitsburg scored its first 2 points of the game with 5 minutes to go in the second quarter. The Tornadoes led 17-8 at halftime. Emmitsburg hung around in the third quarter and cut the Tornadoes' lead to 7 points before Storm Lake pushed it back up to 29-19 heading into the fourth. Following Yanga was Avery DeHaan, who scored 8 points. Maddie Raveling added 5, while Grace Kenkel, Audrey Koski, Kennedy Miller, and Abby Bodholt all had 2 points. Yanga had 5 rebounds, while Kenkel and Mackenzie Harder each had 3. Yanga tallied 2 assists, Raveling and Harder each had 2 steals. Storm Lake was 14 of 42 from the field for 33%, including 3 of 17 from three-point range. The girls played a really great defensive first quarter, Storm Lake coach Richter said. We were able to suffocate the middle and make Emmitsburg take tough contested shots from the outside. We did a good job of holding them to one and done. Our defense paved the way for us again, forcing 23 turnovers and scoring 17 points off turnovers. Offensively, we need to continue to play outside ball, Richter added. We did a much better job of cutting down on turnovers. There is always room for improvement in that area. It was another good team win, moving the focus to Spirit Lake. Next, Storm Lake boys remain unbeaten after topping Emmitsburg. Tornadoes win 59-48. Storm Lake scored 7 unanswered points after Emmitsburg cut the deficit to 4 points late in the third quarter, and the Tornadoes were able to maintain their lead the rest of the game as they defeated the Ehawks 59-48 to remain unbeaten on Tuesday at Tornado Fieldhouse. Storm Lake, with a record of 3-0, held an 11-7 lead after the first quarter before using a 22-1 spurt in the second quarter to take a 33-18 lead at halftime. The Tornadoes led 42-36 entering the fourth period. Emmitsburg cut Storm Lake's 15-point lead to 4 points at 40-36 in the third quarter before Jaden Kuhn dunk sparked a 7-0 run that put Storm Lake ahead 47-36. Charlie Verkston made a 3-pointer during that stretch. Emmitsburg wasn't able to get any closer than 7 points the rest of the way. Storm Lake had balanced scoring as 4 players reached double figures. Kuhn, Verkston, and Justin Gwynn all had 13 points, while Cam Boyd added 12. Carson Lullman had 5 points and David William 3. Kuhn led in rebounding with 13. Lohmann added 7. Bergsten, Boyd, Gwynn, and Kuhn all had 2 assists. Bergsten tallied 3 steals. Boyd, Gwynn, and Kuhn added 2 apiece. Kuhn blocked a pair of shots. Storm Lake made 23 of 46 field goals for 50%, including 6 of 17 from three-point range. That's a really good Emmitsburg team that we just beat, Storm Lake coach Evan Franzmeier said. I am happy for our guys. They have really bought in on the defensive end, and we are improving every day on defense. If we can hold teams in the 40 to 50-point range, we will have a good chance to win. I thought we shared the ball really well, Franzmeier added. 4 guys in double figures, that's hard to defend. Rebounding was a huge focus going into this game, and our kids did an excellent job in that category. Charlie played great on both ends. He was able to get his outside shot to fall and played almost perfect defense on their best shooter all night. Carson Lohmann executed his role very well, just being scrappy and doing all the little things that lead to us winning games. Overall, I'm really happy with our performance, and we are excited for a big game versus Spirit Lake. Storm Lake wrestlers drop match to Spencer. David Santos won his match by pin, but it wasn't enough as Spencer defeated Storm Lake 71-9 in a Lakes Conference dual wrestling meet on Tuesday at Spencer. Santos won his match by pin in 1 minute 26 seconds at 165 pounds. Luis Martinez won by decision 7-2 at 138. Spencer won 8 matches in a row to pull away from a 6-6 tie and make it 53-6 before Martinez snapped the Tigers' streak. It wasn't a very pretty night for us on the mat, but a lot of that credit goes to how good Spencer is, Storm Lake coach Ben Seaman said. They've got an experienced team that's ranked in the top 20 as a dual team. We had 3 or 4 matches that we could have or were winning, and things didn't go our way. It was good for David and Louise to pick up wins for us, but would have been better to grab a few more. It's good for us to wrestle good teams like them and other teams from Saturday to really highlight where we need to get better, Seaman added. Now it's up to us to really start executing better and improving in these phases of our wrestling. Buena Vista edged by Wisconsin Superior by 3. Beavers fall 82-79. Zane Newbaum scored a game-high 32 points and grabbed 6 rebounds, while Gunnar Reed and Michael Santich added 18 and 11 points respectively, but Buena Vista came up short to Wisconsin Superior 82-79 on Tuesday in Superior, Wisconsin. Newbaum finished 10 of 23 from the field and made 5 of 11 from long range while sinking all 7 attempts at the free throw line. Reed was 7 of 11 from the field and fell 1 rebound shy of a double-double. Santich was 4 of 5 from the charity stripe, added 7 rebounds, and charted 4 assists. As a team, the Beavers delivered on 11 of 25 from beyond the arc and also made 14 of 17 free throw opportunities while shooting 44% from the field overall. The Yellow Jackets made 7 first half three-pointers and shot nearly 49% from the field overall. The game was back and forth throughout before a late surge to end the opening half put UW Superior in front 41-30 with less than 2 minutes to play. 3 free throws from Newbaum with 1 second left brought BVU within 9 at the break. Newbaum made a pair of three-pointers to begin the second half and made it a 1-point game with less than 2 minutes gone by. BVU was unable to get any closer the rest of the way. The Yellow Jackets eventually pushed the margin back up to as many as 9 midway through. BVU hung around down the stretch, getting a 3-pointer from Reed with 7 seconds left to make it a 3-point game. After the Yellow Jackets missed a free throw with 6 seconds left, the Beavers had one final chance to tie the game and force overtime, but Ryan Mendoza had his three-point attempt blocked with under 3 seconds left. Buena Vista now has a record of 5 wins and 3 losses overall. In the NFL roundup, Browns survived Jags' late rally. Joe Flacco threw for 311 yards and 3 touchdowns in his home debut for Cleveland, and the Browns survived a late rally by Trevor Lawrence and the Jacksonville Jaguars for a 31-27 win Sunday. The 38-year-old Flacco, who was only signed 3 weeks ago by the Browns, delivered the kind of performance he had almost annually as a visitor with Baltimore. Flacco went 26 of 45 and improved to 10-2 as a starter in Cleveland. Lawrence played despite spraining his right ankle Monday night. He threw a season-high 3 interceptions before bringing the Jaguars back in the fourth quarter. Bills 20, Chiefs 17. Josh Allen threw for 233 yards with touchdowns running and throwing. The Bills kicked a go-ahead field goal with a minute 54 to go, and thanks to a crucial penalty on Chiefs wide receiver Kadarius Toney, Buffalo held on to win in Kansas City. The Chiefs thought they'd taken the lead with less than 2 minutes remaining when Patrick Mahomes hit Travis Kelce over the middle and the high school quarterback threw far across the field to Toney, who ran the rest of the 49 yards for a touchdown. Only one problem. Toney had lined up offside. The penalty wiped out the play. Bears 28, Lions 13. Justin Fields threw for a touchdown and ran for another, and host Chicago played its most impressive game of the season, beating NFC North leading Detroit. Receiver DJ Moore had his first career rushing touchdown and caught a scoring pass to help Chicago win for the third time in 4 games. Ravens 37, Rams 31 in overtime. Tylan Wallace returned a punt 76 yards for a touchdown in overtime to lift host Baltimore over Los Angeles, snapping the Rams' 3-game winning streak. Jets 30, Texans 6. Zach Wilson threw a pair of second-half touchdown passes in his return from a 2-game benching. Host New York shut down C.J. Stroud before Houston star rookie quarterback left late with a concussion, and the Jets ended a 5-game losing streak. Wilson was 27 of 36 for 301 yards. Bengals 34, Colts 14. Jake Browning threw 2 touchdown passes and ran for another in his second straight outstanding performance for Cincinnati, which pounded Indianapolis at home. Saints 28, Panthers 6. Derek Carr returned from a recent concussion and upper body injuries to throw touchdown passes to Chris Olave and Jimmy Graham, and host New Orleans beat hapless Carolina. 49ers 28, Seahawks 16. Debo Samuel scored on a catch and run as host San Francisco won its 11th straight division game, beating Seattle. Broncos 24, Chargers 7. Russell Wilson threw 2 touchdowns and Denver won at the Chargers after Los Angeles lost quarterback Justin Herbert due to a finger injury in the first half. Wilson completed 21 of 33 for 224 yards, including a 46-yard touchdown to Cortland Sutton in the third quarter. Vikings 3, Raiders 0. Minnesota and Las Vegas played the lowest-scoring NFL game in 16 years, with Greg Joseph's 36-yard field goal lifting the Vikings on the road. Buccaneers 29, Falcons 25. Baker Mayfield threw an 11-yard touchdown pass to Cade Otton with 31 seconds remaining, capping a wild fourth quarter that pushed Tampa Bay into a tie for first place in the NFC South by winning at Atlanta. And Cowboys 33, Eagles 13. Dak Prescott threw for 2 touchdowns, Brandon Aubrey made 4 field goals, and Dallas beat Philadelphia for its 15th straight home win. Aubrey extended his NFL record by going 30 for 30 on field goals to start his career. In the NBA, Halliburton's star on the rise after impressive tournament. Indiana Pacers guard Tyrese Halliburton just wants to win. He doesn't care about his stats, he doesn't want to be put in any conversations regarding all-star teams, and he certainly isn't interested in talks about being an MVP candidate. He just wants to win. And while it may not have happened Saturday night when the Los Angeles Lakers beat Indiana 123-109 in the inaugural in-season tournament championship game, the rest of the league should be on notice about Halliburton and the Pacers. I think last year we snuck up on teams. Teams didn't really know what to expect, said Halliburton, who had 20 points and 11 assists. But I think now when you play the Pacers, you know what to expect. Obviously, people didn't expect us to get here, the championship game, but I think teams are prepared for us. Indiana gets back to the regular season Monday night with the league's number one offense, which is averaging 128.4 points, led by Halliburton, who is averaging 26.9 points, 4.2 rebounds, and a league-high 12.1 assists. And whether he likes it or not, those numbers have him almost assuredly on his way to a second straight All-Star appearance and have placed him in early season MVP chatter. In 7 tournament games, he led all players who made it to the final with an average of 26.7 points per game on 52.4% shooting and had 13.3 assists per contest. Tyrese is a great young player that has all the tools, has the personality, and has the desire, Indiana coach Rick Carlisle said. The month, 7 weeks that he's put together so far in this season, people are talking about him for MVP, and rightly so. He was completely unfazed by the limelight, and it brought his game to a higher level during the tournament games. Like Reggie Miller, he's very similar to him, body type, stature, personality, and just overall character. He wants the responsibility for winning and losing, and he wants it unconditionally, and that's special. In the NHL, quick Rangers take down Kings. Micah Zibanejad and Jimmy Vesey scored in the 2nd period. Jonathan Quick made 25 saves against his former team, and the New York Rangers beat the Los Angeles Kings 4-1 on Sunday. The Kings lost their 2nd straight road game after winning an NHL record 11 consecutive games away from home to start the season. Los Angeles lost 3-2 in overtime to the Islanders on Saturday. Vincent Trocheck had 3 assists, while Johnny Brodzinski and Willie Kyle also scored for the Rangers. Quick, who improved to 8-0-1, lost his shutout bid when Philip Danault scored a power play goal at 6:37 of the 3rd period. Panthers defeat the Blue Jackets 5-2. Gustav Forsling had a goal and an assist, and Florida scored 3 times in the 3rd period to defeat Columbus. Carter Verhaag recorded his 200th career point, and Sam Reinhart had 4 assists for his 13th multi-point game this season. Anthony Stolar stopped 18 shots for the Blue Jackets, who have won 3 straight and 4 of the last 5 on the road. Oilers 4, Devils 1. Calvin Picard made 26 saves for his first victory in nearly 2 years, and Edmonton ran its win streak to 7 by beating visiting New Jersey. Picard last won in the NHL on January 28th of the year 2022. Jets 4, Ducks 2. Winnipeg rallied past host Anaheim by scoring 4 goals in the 3rd period after falling behind 2-0. Gabriel Vilardi scored the game winner. Predators 2, Canadiens 1. Colton Sissons scored 2 goals. Jose Saros made 36 saves, and Nashville defeated host Montreal. Captain Roman Josi assisted on both goals. Capitals 4, Blackhawks 2. Nick Dowd scored twice, and Washington beat Chicago in the Windy City. The Capitals scored 3 times in a span of 7 minutes and 12 seconds in the 2nd period to take the lead. Wild 3, Kraken 0. Matt Boldy, Marco Rossi, and Joel Eriksson Ek scored. Philip Gustafsson made 24 saves to record the 5th shutout of his career, and Minnesota defeated host Seattle. Golden Knights 5, Sharks 4 in a shootout. Jack Eichel and Jonathan Marchessault scored in the shootout to lift Vegas over visiting San Jose. Mike Hoffman tied the game late in the 3rd for the Sharks. We'll round out today's reading of the Sioux City Journal with an article from Ask Amy. It's entitled Parents Struggle to Handle Child's Stress from School. Dear Amy, my son is 8 years old and is very talkative and inquisitive. He asks a lot of why questions that don't always coincide with the current conversation but are about a previous topic. His 2 reading teachers have said that he is disrespectful and does not participate enough in class. We have talked about this, both with the teachers and with him. He comes home with complete papers, does well on spelling tests, and is above grade level on reading assignments. What they say and what we see coming home doesn't make sense. We have asked for examples of situations when he's disrespectful so we can talk to him about it, but the teachers become vague and won't give an example. His other teachers say he is kind and helpful while also being a bit too talkative, but they say he is on track and doing well. We want to help solve the issue with his reading teachers, but can't seem to get straight answers. He comes home crying sometimes because his reading teachers seem to react so negatively to him. He's a good kid, an only child, and we don't feel he's disrespectful at home. Any advice on how to tackle this? I'm worried that I'm just not seeing something, and this is uncharted territory for me. Signed, Uncharted. Dear Uncharted, your son's teachers are telling you that your son has problems, or creates problems, in their classroom. Without details or examples, you don't have any way to coach your son toward improved behavior. It is ironic, to say the least, that his reading teachers communicate so poorly. You should start by emailing both of the teachers, thank them for teaching your son, and explain simply and briefly that you are eager to help resolve some of the issues they've raised. You might engage them more thoroughly if you basically throw yourself on their mercy by adding something like, "We are first-time parents and he is our only child, so we don't have any prior experience dealing with educational or learning problems. We really want to help him succeed, so please detail very plainly and specifically any behavior which you believe needs correction. We welcome your specific suggestions and guidance for how to help him to be the respectful and engaged pupil you deserve to teach." After this blatant appeal for help, you should also kick this issue upstairs to the academic counselor and/or principal. Meeting personally with these educators would help to give you a game plan, and it could also put the school administration on notice that these particular teachers are not necessarily setting your son up for success in school. This is a critical stage for your son. He could emerge as a lively little boy who is excited to learn, or a frustrated child who doesn't like going to school. That brings us to the end of today's reading in the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.